This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I'm grateful for your company on this Sunday afternoon. Did you remember to spring forward last night? We are now in daylight saving time. Well, in the next half hour, we will spring into a preview of this week's Festival of the Book in Charlottesville. And we'll hear what some Virginia lawmakers are saying about the prospect that Donald Trump will be leading the Republican presidential ticket in November. We've also got The Spark and Our Island Universe coming up. But first, this. Last year, Virginia allowed patients with epilepsy to possess certain medical marijuana oils. Earlier this last week, the General Assembly voted to allow these oils to be manufactured and distributed in-state. So epileptic patients, but only epileptic patients, can get them without crossing state lines. But the laws still leave patients suffering from other diseases feeling marginalized. WMRA's Jesse Nadler explores what some people are calling medical discrimination.
On the one hand, champions of medical marijuana should be happy that legislation in Virginia is moving forward at all. The state is not exactly on the forefront of progressive pot laws. On the other, it's very tense and frustrating for those suffering from diseases that research has shown medical marijuana can help. Everything from cancer, Parkinson's, arthritis, to Crohn's. Take the case of Anne, not her real name because she's been breaking the law for the past 5 months. She illegally obtains cannabis oils from another state to treat her son's Crohn's disease.
For my son to use it with Crohn's disease, that is considered illegal. In my opinion, it's considered medical discrimination.
When her son was first diagnosed in 2014 with Crohn's, an autoimmune disease that attacks the gastrointestinal tract, the doctor prescribed the drug Remicade that came with a long list of alarming side effects, notably T-cell lymphoma. Anne and her husband sought a non-toxic alternative. She began researching how cannabis oils were being used to treat diseases, ranging from epilepsy to Crohn's. She eventually tracked down a grower in Colorado, where marijuana is legal, willing to sell his patented high-strain cannabidiol, or CBD, oil to treat a disease not included in Virginia's medical pot laws. CBD is an anti-inflammatory that does not produce a high.
It was very nerve-wracking. We were scared because there's a social stigma with cannabis, and so I was scared of what people were going to think about a mother giving her son marijuana, fearful of what could happen to me. They would, you know, if I was ever arrested, they would probably take my kids away.
Her fears are not unfounded. Last year, a Kansas woman was arrested and had her son temporarily taken from her after police searched her home and found cannabis oil used to treat her Crohn's disease.
I am disgusted. Personally offended.
Jen Michelle Padini is a two-time cancer survivor and executive director of Cannabis Commonwealth, a coalition that champions cannabis reform in Virginia. She testified before lawmakers last month in support of adding cancer to the law that protects those who use cannabis oils to treat epilepsy. The proposed amendment was killed last month by a Republican-led subcommittee.
Say it to my face. Tell me why I am less deserving. Tell me why I have to die in this state and that patient doesn't. What makes them more deserving than me?
It's not a question of better research on medical marijuana as a treatment for epilepsy, says Mike Lazuski of Americans for Safe Access. ASA lobbies for safe legal access to cannabis for therapy and research. He says optics play a role.
I think one of the reasons why we've seen 17 states since 2014 adopt these CBD laws that in almost every instance only allow for epilepsy or seizure disorders is because you have parent advocates advocating for children. It's very hard for an ALS patient to advocate for themselves. Someone who's an adult with moderate to severe Crohn's, they're dealing with paying rent, all the other things that go on in life, and you know, coming down to Richmond to meet with their elected officials just might not be something that they can do, especially since Virginia has such a short legislative session.
ASA's stance is that physicians, not legislators, should decide which patients can benefit from cannabis therapy. It shouldn't come down to which group can more effectively lobby lawmakers. Yet that is precisely what patients will have to keep doing until the laws become more inclusive.
You know, I think the best thing patients in that type of situation can do is to write letters and call their senators and representatives who are elected in Richmond, and let them know that they're excluded from this law. You know, the best standard for a medical cannabis law is not the strictest one, but the one that helps provide wellness to the most patients who could benefit from it.
As for Ann's son, he has been in remission for 5 months and is hashtag illegally healed, a growing online movement of medical pot lawbreakers. Ann and her son recently went for a follow-up with their gastrointestinal doctor.
He was surprised and he said, well, I don't know what you guys are doing, but keep doing it.
She didn't tell the GI that she has to break the law to do it. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Among Virginia's congressional delegation, there is a growing realization that Donald Trump may very well win the GOP nomination for president. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Politicians are known for being outspoken, but there's been a strange quietness, even uneasiness, at the Capitol these days. It happens when you ask the bulk of Republicans about the prospect of having Donald Trump as the Republican presidential nominee. After Trump won the Virginia primary, none of the state's Republicans endorsed him. But Congressman Dave Brat says he understands why Trump won the Commonwealth.
Says the American people are utterly frustrated right now because we have out-of-control budget problems, unfunded liability problems, and Congress isn't doing its work in a timely manner.
GOP leaders fear vulnerable Republican incumbents will lose their seats if Trump wins the nomination. But Virginia Republican Congressman Rob Whitman says it's too early for such predictions.
I have no idea. There is so much water over the dam that'll flow between now and the general election. Who knows? And I'm not a prognosticator, so I'll let others that are more skilled at that make those judgments.
While retiring Virginia Republican Congressman Scott Ridgel is vowing not to support Trump if he's the party's nominee, other Virginia Republicans are vowing to back him if he wins.
I will support the Republican nominee, whomever that is.
That's Virginia Republican Congressman Morgan Griffith. He says he understands why Trump did well with voters in his southwestern district.
And our major industries were textiles, gone because of policies here. Furniture, gone because of policies here. Some may say that it's okay that we lost tobacco. That was another mainstay in our area. And now the coal fields have been devastated by this administration. And it's all coming out of Washington, and they're mad as hell.
Democrats were initially dismissive of Trump's chances in the general election. But now they're also bracing for a bruising fight in the Commonwealth in November.
And if there's anything that's been shown the last year, conventional wisdom has been almost always wrong.
That's Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner. He says his party can't take anything for granted this year.
But anybody that underestimates him, you've got a whole line of Republican candidates who've underestimated him. Virginia's going to be a tight state.
Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine says if Trump keeps racking up victories and wins the GOP primary, it will change the electoral map in Virginia.
He will also put a lot of voters out for us. People see Trump's candidacy for what it is, and they're very, very worried about it, and they don't think it reflects the values of this country. So I think he may pull out some new voters on his side if he's the nominee, but he's also going to be very, very effective in energizing Democratic voters.
While it's still early to be making predictions about the general election, many pundits and politicians are now bracing for a Trump win. But one thing no one will deny, Virginia voters will be vital in choosing who's the next president. Reporting from the Capitol, I'm Matt Laszlo.
The Black Lives Matter movement has revived discussion of a problem that has persisted in this nation's history since the time of slavery, the unequal treatment of African Americans by police and by the justice system. And that's the subject of a new book by Ross Howell about a black teenager who was executed in Virginia more than 100 years ago. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Houseman has details.
Ross Howell Jr.'s book, Forsaken, tells the story of a 16-year-old African-American girl convicted of killing a white woman from Hampton who employed her to do laundry. It was 1912, and lawyers kept Virginia Christian off the stand because they feared racial unrest if she were to testify.
She was upset that she had not been allowed to tell her side of the story. And so she asked that newspaper reporters be brought to her cell, where she confessed to the crime, but she explained that there had been an argument about a missing locket and that the woman had struck her with a piece of crockery. There were shards of ceramic found at the murder site, and that an altercation had followed, and when the widow wouldn't stop screaming, she had suffocated her.
Because she was so young, Hal says, Christian wasn't actually eligible for the death penalty.
The Constitution of Virginia specified that a juvenile should not be executed or even incarcerated. So what was supposed to happen to her was she would be put in an institution where she would learn a trade and some determination would be made on her fate at a later date. Unfortunately, at that time, there was no such institution for black girls.
So the court sentenced her to die in the electric chair. The case provoked outrage in other parts of the country, and black newspapers in cities like Chicago took up the cause. Some letters of protest are on file at the Library of Virginia, where Roger Christman serves as a senior archivist. He had actually used the case of Virginia Christian to learn the library's collection when he began work there in 1997.
I had previously worked at the South Carolina State Archives, and I had done my thesis on juvenile executions in South Carolina in the 20th century. They executed seven, including one who was 14 years old. Doing that type of research helps you learn the collection. If there's a coroner's inquest, there's coroner's records. There's a court record. There's newspapers. If they go to the penitentiary, there's Department of Correctional Records.
After reading Howell's book called Forsaken, Christman created a digital bibliography, chapter by chapter, allowing the public to go online and see all the documents, letters, and photographs that Ross Howell studied before writing the book.
Even though it's a novelization, the framework is about the records of that case that are here in the library. It's really showing a creative use of our collection.
Perhaps the most compelling thing on that website is a photo of Virginia Christian before she was transferred to the penitentiary. Again, author Ross Howell.
You see a child who is alone, fearful, and it's hard to look at that photograph and turn away.
Howell says he couldn't turn away, and he's profoundly honored by Christman's website.
For something like this to happen to me as a writer, I have to tell you, it's just unbelievable. I'm still sort of getting my head around it.
The author can say thanks in person when he speaks at the Library of Virginia in Richmond this Wednesday at noon. And both will meet another interested party, according to library spokeswoman Jan Hathcock.
We are hoping to have in the audience Agena Rogers, the descendant of the lead attorney who defended Virginia Christian back in 1912.
The program is free and open to the public, as is the Virginia Festival of the Book, where Howell will appear on a panel March 17th. In Charlottesville. I'm Sandy Houseman.
I'm Chanel Verani, and this is Our Island Universe. We do not see the night sky here in the valley the way that our predecessors just 50 years ago would have seen it. The Milky Way, our home galaxy that once shined brilliantly overhead against the black of night, has almost disappeared completely from our sky. It is estimated that 90% of Americans now live in areas where they no longer see the Milky Way. Does it matter? What do we lose when we lose the night? Light pollution is so much more than just the disappearing stars. The overuse and misuse of artificial light at night wastes money, wastes energy, endangers our physical, mental, and spiritual health, takes a tremendous environmental toll, and erases the stars from our skies. The International Dark Sky Association estimates that one-third of all lighting is wasted at an annual cost of more than $2 billion. Many fixes are simple, like turning off lights when they're not being used, installing motion sensors, and shielding the light so that it's directed down onto the ground where it's needed, not up where it's not. Let's bring back our dark, starry nights that generations of Americans took for granted. I am Chanel Verani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. The Spark this week is about a high school junior's contribution to this year's Newbery's. You know, the fabled medal and three honors awarded annually for distinguished contribution to American literature for children? Eleanor Alger is the junior at Harrisonburg High. Eleanor's an aspiring musical theater performer who's trained hard at singing and dancing for years. Why? Because she loves to sing and dance. But she also, Eleanor tells me, loves to read.
I love reading.
My parents have always read to me ever since I was very, very young, freshly born. It's a really weird way of saying it, but ever since I was like a baby. And I actually taught myself how to read. right around the age I was turning 4, I memorized books. I would memorize like Go Dog Go. And then I would make the connections between like what the words that I already knew and the shapes on the page. And it's really funny. My mom loves this story. We were in Vermont in a bookstore and I was looking around and I picked up a book and I started reading it out loud. My parents like had seen me read out loud before they'd because I had memorized them. So it's really just me reciting them. 4-ish. Yeah. Maybe around that age, maybe a little younger. And I just started reading it. My mom said, "Have you read that before?" I said, "No." And she said she was starting to like, figure out something. So she grabs another book off the shelf and she gives it to me and she goes, "Read this. Like, can you read what's on the page?" And I started reading it. And I was mispronouncing a few words, but I was reading. And my mom like called my dad and she was crying. She's like, "She learned how to read. Like, she taught herself how to read." I read the whole Les Mis book, the Les Miserables. I read that in fourth grade because I'd just seen the musical. So
The Hugo,
the really big one. They call it the brick for a reason.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by.
I've just really enjoyed reading, and I read as much as I can, as often as I can.
Now, why? We say we enjoy this and we enjoy that, but what about reading lights your fire?
I can tie this into theater a lot, actually, because I love world building and stories. Like, those are two of my absolute favorite things. I'm an only child, and my parents, like, were always very attentive to me. But, like, my dad works a lot, and there was a lot of times where I had to entertain myself. I was not lonely as a child, like, don't get me wrong. But I would just entertain myself and I would just read. And that really helped me to discover that, you know, there are like these other worlds. I learned so much, like so much of what I know and like who I am is based on what I have read and the stories that have been there. And some of my favorite memories have been related to books.
Okay, so now on to Eleanor Alger's unofficial but vital part in the Newbery selection process.
For the Newbery Award for the Children's Literature, they have a panel of judges who are literary professors and teachers and librarians and all sorts of people who are very involved in the book world from across the country. And each of those people has to read about 500 books over the course of a year from January 1st to December 31st. And so there's a professor at JMU, Joan Kindig, who's a wonderful, wonderful person. And she knew that I loved reading so much, so she asked me if I would help her plow through some of the 500 books. She has to read any book that is recommended to her.
Who's doing the recommending?
It's not necessarily other people on the panel, but it's like an under committee type thing.
The committee of recommenders.
The committee of recommenders, if you will. Yes. And so whenever a book gets recommended, she has to read it. And that's been such an incredible process. I think I read my last book on the 28th or so. I was reading most of the 12 to 14 age range, because technically the Newbery, their Newbery range is like 0 to 14.
Mm-hmm.
So she was having me read a lot of the older kid books instead of like The Boy Has a Ball, The Boy Chases the Ball. And that was really interesting.
What did she tell you to look for?
It's a lot of story building and characters. You know when you read a good book. Mm-hmm. You also have to keep in mind there were some books that I loved and would totally read again and have read again, but they were definitely too mature for Newbery age. They dealt with some heavier themes that might have been about appropriate for a 14-year-old, but certainly not for a 12 or 11-year-old who would pick up a book that has a Newbery medal on the cover and start reading. There was books that dealt with issues of like drugs and gender identity and sex and all these other types of things. And those were books that as a high school junior, like made sense for me to read because those are issues that I am familiar with. But for younger kids, definitely not. So it was a lot of looking through that, putting those books aside, saying, I don't think these books would work for the Newbery, but I did like them.
Do you keep notes?
Yes, there's an app called Book Crawler.
No kidding.
Yes. What you do is you can scan in like the ISBN code from the back of a book. And it will load it in and you can like write comments on the book and it tells you like the publication date and the author and like the publishing house. That really helped me keep track of things. I didn't just have papers everywhere. The two books that I loved the most I read towards the beginning of the year in February, March or so. And those two actually got awards.
And what were they?
I feel accomplished. One was Echo by Pam Munoz Ryan. That was one of the best books I've ever read, honestly. And it followed like three different characters. And it's first when you read it, it seems like they have three very separate stories. But she begins to weave them together and the way she did that. And there's a lot of musical elements to it.
Which you like.
Which I loved. And the other one was The War Saved My Life I can't remember the author off the top of my head, but that was really good. It's a World War II story. This girl has twisted foot, and so it's about her with that disability, and the kids got sent out from London to the country, and her overcoming that disability and finding a family there. And those two are just really, really powerful stories. So I told Joan, I was like, I really liked these books. And so then she read them, and she really loved the books, and apparently the other people on the panel really loved the books as well, because they got honored, and I was really excited.
Now, when you were reading, did you have permission to read just as you, Eleanor Alger, and what I think of these books, or were you trying to turn yourself into the mind of a sort of regular, all-American 12 to 14-year-old?
After I read those first two books, I mentioned The War That Saved My Life and Echo. That kind of set a standard for what the books should be. And I've read a bunch of Newbery books beforehand. I own a few, so I went back and reread those when I was first approached about this project. And that was helpful, just to know the level that I should be considering. It didn't feel that big, that large scale, when I was in the middle of reading books, like on a plane to somewhere. But towards the end of the process, as I was narrowing down my favorites and Joan was narrowing down her favorites, and there was lots of overlap, we started talking about when she would go to, I think, Chicago or Boston and meet with the other committee members and talk about what books they wanted to be honored. And she said, oh, my favorite thing about the process is we get to call the authors ourselves. We get to call them and say, your book has won the Newbery. And she was talking about how amazing that's, like, her favorite part. Best part of the process. And as she was telling you this, I was sitting there going, I've recommended these books. Like, there's a person who wrote this book who's attached, like an actual person who has this whole life like I do, and they wrote this book and it might win a Newbery because I liked it. And that sort of, as soon as that hit me, I realized that this is a process so much bigger than me. And that was a really, really humbling moment, I guess.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by. Hope was high and life worth living.
Some Newbery links and pictures of Eleanor Alger are on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. You'll find all of the stories from the WMRA newsroom at WMRA.org, where we're also asking you to go and make a contribution during our Spring More News, Less Noise fund drive, just a little more than a week to go. And when you're on Facebook, be sure to click like at WMRA Public Radio, and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.